forms for that.
Okay. How to show Karen how to work the machine.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, we're still swirling. Good, we're live now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. This is our weekly foray into the weekly Torah portion. We have to use different adjectives every week. We can try that. All right, this week's Torah portion is Terumah. So here's how we got here. We have read about slavery in Egypt. We have read about the Exodus from Egypt. We have read about Revelation at Sinai. We have read about the Ten Commandments and other forms of law and civil law and all those things. Fantastic. After all of that, the Torah begins discussing the next major project. What is the next major Jewish project? Building a home for God. This Torah portion is Terumah. You can find it on page 510, 511. Terumah and Tetzaveh, the divine command given to Moses by God, how to build the Mishkan. What is the Mishkan? What's the English translation of Mishkan? Help me out here. Tabernacle. Tabernacle is a precursor to the Holy Temple. It's the portable sanctuary that traveled with the Jewish people. So the Torah portion of Terumah exclusively deals with the construction plans for the Mishkan. The Jewish people are not yet building it. That will come in a few Torah portions. But here's where they get the blueprint of how to build it, with what to build it, what should be donated, etc. So let's begin the Torah portion 511. Ray, please get us started. Chapter 25, Exodus, page 511. You got it?
Got it.
Beautiful. All right. Take it away at your leisure.
Starting at what, where?
Right. God spoke to Moshe saying. Do you have it? 511. There we go.
God spoke to Moshe saying, speak to the children of Israel and have them dedicate to me a contribution. Take my offering from every person whose heart inspires him to generosity. These are the types of contribution that you shall collect from them: gold, silver, and copper, turquoise, purple, and crimson, wool, linen and goat's hair, ram skins, dyed red, multicolored tachash skins, and acacia wood, oil for the eternal lamp, spices for the anointing oil, and for the incense fumes, shoham stones and filling stones for the apron and for the breastplate.
So this is a big wish list, right? You think that when that couple got married and they had that registry, you think that was a big list. God's got this whole list here. Here's what I need. I need gold, silver, copper. I need this material, that fiber, this. Yeah, all this whole list, things that were needed for the building of the tabernacle. Turn the page to 513. Hold on. Did you finish? Yeah, you finished that page. Two more lines until it says the ark. 513.
They should make a sanctuary dedicated to me, and I will dwell among them. You should make the tabernacle and the design of all its vessels according to all that I show you.
Okay, here we go. So God is saying we need to launch the campaign, capital campaign. We're building a building. It's called a Mishkan. And why is it called a Mishkan? Because Mishkan means a dwelling place. Mishkan is kind of like an indwelling, a place where the divine presence is going to dwell. And God says, in order for this to happen, I need you all to contribute to build this edifice, to build this space for me. The rest of the Torah portion talks about the items, the vessels, basically the furniture of the Mishkan, including the ark. You know what? Let's turn some pages while we're doing this. 513, we have the ark. On 517, we have the table. We have the menorah. 519, we have the coverings of the tabernacle. On 525, the walls and contents of the tabernacle. And that kind of takes us The copper altar, the courtyard of the tabernacle, and that takes us to the end of the Torah portion. So this week's parasha, this week's Torah portion, is all about the materials that are needed and the construction of the Mishkan and the vessels that were present in the Mishkan. Fine. But what's interesting is that God says the following, Va'asuli Mikdash, top of page 513, they shall make for me a sanctuary. In other words, build this edifice, Vishachanti, and God says, and I will dwell Besocham amongst them. And our sages point out the grammatical anomaly. God is saying, build a sanctuary, and you would think the rest of the sentence grammatically would say, build a sanctuary and I will dwell in it. But no, God says, Va'asli Mikdash, build a sanctuary, Vishachanti Besocham, and I will dwell within them. Who's them? The Jewish people, but specifically in the plural. And as the commentaries point out, what is v'shachanti besochem, I'll dwell within them, but besoch echad ve'echad, within every single individual, that is where God's presence dwells, which takes us to the major theme of this week's Torah portion. If you and I want to have a relationship with God, then it behooves us to model our lives after the construction of the Mishkan. Again, let me connect those dots one more time. God says, back in the day, 3,300 years ago, in the desert, in the Sinai desert, God says, build this edifice and I will dwell amongst you. The commentaries say amongst you means not collectively only, but individually, amongst you individually. We don't have a temple today, so the mystics tell us that to house, a relationship with God, to house God's presence in our own lives. You and I can achieve that by recreating the temple and the various vessels, the kelim of the Mishkan in our own lives, which means that you and I can make an altar. Sorry, you and I can make an ark. You and I can make a menorah. You and I can make a table, shulchan. You and I can make an altar, a golden altar, a copper altar. And when we do so, we create a magnificent edifice for God. Why is that important? Well, I think for many of us, there's a sense that a realization that kicks in at some point in life that whatever we're being sold on is really not where it's at. In other words, like the world sells us on things that will make us happy, things that will satisfy us, things that will make us feel better and fulfilled. So it says, if you want to feel good, so you have to buy this device. Or if you want to feel good, you have to live in this place or buy this kind of car or buy this type of house. Or as the Rebbe would say back in the day, decades ago, to be a really important person, you have to have wall-to-wall carpeting. This was back in the day when that was apparently a thing. And then it's changed and everyone ripped up the wall-to-wall carpeting, right? But back in the day, the Rebbe would often, tongue-in-cheek, mention wall-to-wall carpeting as a sign, a status symbol for having made it. But at some point, we realize that wall-to-wall carpeting doesn't actually do anything for us. Why? Because however we felt before we got the wall-to-wall carpeting, after the wall-to-wall carpeting, after the initial wall-to-wall wears off, or carpeting wears off, we revert back to where we were, which might be dissatisfied, especially dissatisfied because I spent all this money and it still didn't work, so now I'm really dissatisfied, right? If I hadn't spent the money, so I'm living happiness on the cheap. So what do I expect anyway? But I invested so much money in my happiness and I'm still not happy. Come on. Why is this not working? The magic wall-to-wall carpeting is not working. So at some point or another, we as human beings, we have this realization that all the material stuff, yeah, it's temporarily, it's nice. You know, feels good in the moment. But it's not the answer. What's the answer? The answer is a deeper relationship in life, a deeper relationship with life itself, with God, with meaning, with purpose, living in a deeper way for something higher. That's what really makes us feel satisfied in the long run, not in the short term, but in the long term, doing something meaningful, living a meaningful life. That's what really makes us feel better. So let's circle back. To live a meaningful life, to live a connected life, to live a higher life, right? It means to live a Mishkan life, a sanctuary, a holy space life. And how do you have a holy space? Well, look at the ingredients of the Mishkan. So if you want to create, you and I wish to create holiness in our lives, the template is mapped out in this week's Torah portion. Next week, we talk about the high priests and the garments that the priests wore. Wonderful. But this week is all about creating a holy space. So if we want to create a holy space, and we do, even if you don't realize it, right? We want to create that holy space because that's the only thing that's going to work for us. So if you want to create that holy space, how to create it? How do we create it? We look at this week's Torah portion at the template that said, in ancient times, 3,300 years ago, this template worked then, and it works now within each and every one of us individually. Make sense? So this is where we're going with this. We're going to look at the structure to recreate it spiritually, psychologically, emotionally in our own lives. Okay, so if I asked you the question, what was the core, what was the most important thing in the Mishkan? Now I know. To have a Mishkan, to have a tabernacle, you had to have everything, all the things. Fine. Granted, that's the safe answer. That's the PC answer. But if I ask you, what do you think is like the crown jewel, if you will, the epicenter of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, what would you say? Of like, what's the greatest thing? Tablets that were in the Ark. What else? Tablets. Anyone else say anything else?
The menorah.
Menorah was cool, okay.
It's an abstract of holiness.
So the holiness itself, Tzuguzin. Okay. But I'm asking for the vessels themselves, which is the greatest? Okay, the Ark. And the Ark makes sense. We'll see soon how Nachmanides says, indeed, the Ark is not only at the epicenter of the Holy of Holies, but it is the crowning achievement or the crowning vessel of the Mishkan, and that's why it's the first one that's mentioned after the command. Look at page 513. You might still be on the page on that page 513. Right after God says these are the items that we need to build it, God says, here's how you make an ark. Why is the ark mentioned first? Ramban and others say, you know why? Because it's the holiest piece. Let's take a look at what Nachmanides says. Take a look. Let's open up the Torah Studies booklets or books to text number 2, page 84. All right, Steve, are you ready? Page 8, no pressure. Page 84, don't worry, we'll wait for you. Page 84 or 85, I'm not sure what it's on. 84, text 2, Ramban, Nachmanides. Now, again, I always love saying this, Nachmanides, classic biblical commentary, plus he was a mystic to boot. I don't know why to boot, but he was also a mystic. So sometimes he throws in some Kabbalah, not necessarily here, but sometimes some Kabbalah. But here he explains what was the core of the temple. Please take it away.
God personally told the Jews the Ten Commandments and transmitted through Moses additional mitzvot, which are central to the Torah, as a rabbi would do with a prospective convert. The Jews then themselves all they heard from Moses, and God formed a covenant with them. They were now his nation, and he was their God. Now the time was ripe for a home to house the glory among them. Thus he commanded them to build the tabernacle, and there he would speak to Moses and relay his commandments to the people. Now the primary object in the tabernacle was the seat of his glory, the ark, as it is written, and I will arrange my meetings with you there, and I will speak with you from atop the ark cover. It is for this reason that the Torah first speaks of the ark and its cover, because it is the most important element of the tabernacle. This is the idea of the tabernacle, a place where the glory that was present at Sinai would reside. When Moses would come there, he would hear the same voice that he heard at Sinai.
How would you characterize Nachmanides' commentary? What is he saying? What's the primary object in the tabernacle?
The ark.
Why? What happens at the ark?
That's where God talks.
In other words, that's where God is, that's where God communicates, and that's where the message, the directives come forth from God. Just like God communicated at Sinai with the Ten Commandments, God continued to communicate from the space above the ark to Moses, to the Jewish people, and that is basically the point, you know, the point of like the nexus, if you will, the point of contact between God and the Jewish people, or God and Moses. That's where all the magic happens. So he says clearly, the space where God communicates his will, that is what the tabernacle is all about. In other words, what is the Mishkan? What is the tabernacle? A space where God communicates what he wants. And where that happened? By the ark. So the ark is clearly the central piece of the tabernacle. Make sense?
But he didn't speak to the people anymore, did he? After they heard
he spoke to Moses.
Right.
Yeah. So it was through Moses to the Jewish people. But that's where God expressed what he wanted. Right? That's where God said what he wants. At the space of the ark. Now, that's all the opinion of Ramban. Rambam, Nachmanides. Maimonides has a different take. If you look in Maimonides, Mishneh Torah, where he is opening the opening halacha, the opening law, in his Laws of the Temple, page 85, text number 3, take a look. Alex, please read this. Take a look at how Maimonides characterizes the temple.
It is a positive commandment to construct a house for God, a place where the sacrifices will be offered.
Look what he says. What is the mitzvah? The mitzvah is to create a place, a house for God. And what defines a home for God? The place where?
Sacrifices.
To him, what's the most important piece of the Mishkan or the Beis HaMikdash?
It's basically the
altar. The Mizbeach, the altar. This is a classic machlok, the classic dispute amongst the Rishonim, amongst the early medieval sages that talked in these terms. Like, what's the focal point of the Mishkan? What's the focal point of the temple? Nachmanides, Ramban says it's the Ark. And you all said the Ark, by the way, just to recap. You didn't. Okay. At least the majority said the... it's true. You did not say that. The majority said the ark. But Maimonides says, in his opening line of the laws of the temple, he says, there's a positive commandment, God says, to build him a home. And what designates a home as a home for God? If it's set up for sacrifices. That's what makes it. He doesn't say if it has an ark with tablets inside. He says a place, what is a temple? A place, muchan lihios makriven bo akabanos, a place set up for offerings to be brought. That's what makes it a Mishkan. That's what makes it a temple, a mikdash. A different take, totally different take. So what we want to do today is analyze what is an ark and what is an altar. Why does one opinion say that the ark was the definition of the temple? And why does the other opinion say that the altar was the definition of the temple? Why does one say this and one say that? What is an ark? What is an altar? And to make things even more fun, I'm going to throw in one more vessel. No extra charge tonight. Free of charge. We're going to discuss arks, altars, and shulchan. What is the shulchan?
Table.
The table. The table. What table? We'll talk about this in a moment. So before we get to the table inside our text, I want to show you pictures of the table. Now, I love this chumash in part because it has pictures in these Torah portions. And it's fantastic. So take a look at 5:15. Let's visualize what we're talking about. 5:15, you have a picture of the ark. Okay, that's Ramban. Nachmanides says the ark was the definition of the temple. That was where you wanted to be, the ark. Okay, that's where God communicated his will. That's where all the magic happened. Great. 5:17, we now have a picture of the table. So what is the table? Let's talk about the shulchan. I would say of all the vessels, probably the table is the least known. I'll tell you why I say this. The ark, right? Everyone knows. The ark. What's his name?
You're talking about Harrison Ford.
Of course, Harrison Ford. Obviously. See, you knew what I was talking about before I mentioned it. That's how much we know the ark, right? Harrison Ford. We all know, right? Raiders of the Lost Ark, we all know the ark, right? It's in our lexicon. The menorah, of course we know the menorah. The altar, yeah. Don't people get married Right? Isn't there an altar with marriage also? It's different. But isn't it called the altar?
It's called the altar.
It is called the altar, right?
Yeah.
I don't know why. It just came to me. Yeah. Came to me in a vision. No. So, but altar, yeah, place where the sacrifice were. Okay, fine. But what was the temple? Sorry, temple. What was the table? What was the shulchan? What was that all about? Look at the picture. So if this were a color picture, you would see that it's sparkly gold, shiny gold. So there was a base. If you look at the right side of the picture, you see like that looks like my IKEA table that I used to have. You know those IKEA, the lac. You know what I'm talking about. There's a genre of tables.
And the instructions look kind of similar too.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Right? It's you just screw on the legs. 1, 2, 3, 4. Boom.
Well, this was modular furniture.
It was modular. They had to take it apart on some level. Yeah, absolutely. So you had the bottom, the base over there, and then the top part went on top of it, which makes sense. If it's the top part, then it should go on top. So what is the table for? So actually, let's read it inside right here. 517, Karen, because you love the IKEA table reference.
And I love putting the things together.
You know, they opened up a restaurant. IKEA, yeah. But you get like a tray of all the ingredients. You have to make it yourself. That was a joke. All right. The table. Let's read about the table.
You should make a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits in its length, 1 cubit in its width, and 1.5 cubits in its height. You should coat it with pure gold, and you should make for it a golden rimmed edge all around. You should make for it a frame 1 hand breadth in width all around. You should make a golden rimmed edge for its frame all around.
All of this is still talking about only the bottom part. Okay? Yeah, it's a lot of gold. That's where they needed donations. Yeah. That was a lot. Remember this, right? They took they cleaned out Egypt, all the wealth. So they had some gold. They made a golden calf, they had extra gold. It's not like they needed it for like, I don't know, Y2K. You know, they clearly didn't mind just like investing in a calf. So they had gold.
You should make for it 4 golden rings, and you should place the rings on the 4 corners of its 4 legs. The rings should be attached to the legs adjacent to the frame as holders for the poles with which to carry the table.
And all of this, again, is depicted in that bottom right diagram where you have the IKEA looking table with the poles. And I want to see IKEA come out with the table that you can actually just, yeah, poles. Easy to lift. Because it's so hard to lift the actual table. Give me like 4, just 2 poles sticking out. All right, continue.
You should make the poles of acacia wood and you should coat them with gold. The table should be carried with them. You should make its bread molds, its spoons, its separating bars, which will cover the breads and allow ventilation, and its supporting bars. You should make them from pure gold. You should place on the table multi-surface bread before me at multi-surface bread?
Yeah.
Before me at all times.
Yeah, it's a new technology. It's multi-surface bread. It means basically it was baked in a way where it wasn't like open bread, it was like in a mold.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of baked in a mold. So
it wasn't flat bread.
It wasn't flat bread. Okay. Correct. So take a look. You see what's on top of the table? Those are the molds with ventilation. You know, if you have hot bread, it's got a... Doesn't it kind of look like a baker, like a bakery rack? You ever see those bakery racks? They pull them out and it's kind of stacked. So that's, right, that's kind of what it is, on top of the table. So basically, this table held bread. 12 loaves, 6 on each side. 12 rectangular loaves, 6 high. And as we'll see soon, the breads were brought Friday afternoon. And they stayed there on the table to the next Friday, at which point those were taken off and new ones were brought. Every week, once a week, breads were brought and just left there.
What did they do with it?
And how much?
Well, we'll talk about it.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. 1.5 cubits and it's height.
A cubit is about 1.5 feet. It's about the size of an IKEA table.
Well, yeah, it really is.
Yeah, no, it really is, yeah. Right, so like 1.5 cubits, you do 1.5 times 1.5. So what is that? 2? Who knows? 2.25?
Somebody here.
Was it 2.25? Yeah, 1.5.
It was in Bill Cosby's routine years ago.
He said he was
would be 2 1/4.
You know?
Right.
He says, what's a cubit?
Right. I'm trying to build this thing. I have no idea. It's about 2 1/4. Right, so 2 1/4 feet. Yeah, it's about right. And then you put the thing on top, you stack the breads, you're good to go. Now, why the bread stacking, what's going on? That's what we're doing today. We're getting into that. What they do with the breads, who ate the breads, were they burnt, were they eaten? We're going to get into that, all those details. Okay, so take a look at text number 5. Before we get to text 5, if I ask you the question, what do you think they did with the breads? After Friday, they brought the breads. They left it there for a week. Now it's time to bring new, fresh bread. What did they do with the old bread?
Dumped it.
Huh?
Dumped it. They took it somewhere.
All right, here's the deal. I thought that you were going to think that they probably burned it as an offering to God.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, good. So we'll go with you. So you would think, right? Karen at least would think that maybe you take... Right. Maybe you take the breads, and now you burn them, because you don't need them. They're an offering for God, right? You put them in the temple for God, so what else are you going to do other than burn them as an offering to God? Fine. In fact, that's not what happened after all that.
I knew that.
Right. You figure. I was telling that, or whatever it's called. Text number 5, page 87. All right, Jillian, I think we're up to you. Please.
88?
Oh, yeah. Who knows? English on 88? Fantastic. Yeah. Page 88.
The showbread is brought every Shabbat. They are not offered on the altar, but instead are eaten entirely by the priests.
I was going to say that. I knew that.
But I didn't say that.
All right. Oh.
How are the sets of the showbread arranged? 4 priests enter the sanctuary. 2 are holding the 2 sets of bread and 2 the 2 dishes of frankincense. 4 priests enter before them to remove the 2 sets of bread and the 2 dishes of frankincense that were on the table. The priests that enter stand in the north facing the south, and those that depart stand in the south facing the north. These remove the showbread from the previous week, and these place down the new breads. When they departed, they would place the bread on a second golden table that would be placed in the entrance hall. They would offer the incense in, the dishes on the pyre, and afterward the breads were divided to be eaten by the priests.
So there you have it.
Still bread.
Well, there was a miracle that the bread stayed fresh. And there was another miracle that even a little bit of bread, because the shifts of the priests, they had quite a few priests that worked every week. They did a rotation, a weekly rotation. So this was the outgoing shift of that week, got to eat of the breads of that week, and the incoming placed it there, and they would eat at the end of their shift. So part of the miracle was, even though it was a little bit of bread, after they divided it, it was very satisfying, and it satisfied their hunger, even though it wasn't quantitatively a large amount. Qualitatively, it was very rich in satisfaction. Fine.
Do we know what grain it was? No.
It's someone somewhere knows. It's written somewhere.
Wheat?
Yeah, I think it was wheat. Yeah. Should have been wheat.
Teff or spelt or something ancient.
I think it was wheat. Yeah.
They didn't have celiac disease.
I guess not. Or maybe, you know, maybe they opted out. Who knows? Okay, so that's what happened. So here's the question. The question is, what is going on? In the temple, you would think it's a temple for God. So why are we taking bread and feeding it to the Kohanim, to the priests? What's going on here? Right? You would think the temple is a space for divine service. And instead of serving God, what are we doing? We're eating the prophets, or we're eating, not the actual prophets. We're eating the breads that were designated for God. So you put these breads for God, right? God says, make me a table and arrange breads for me. And then we say, okay, now we're done. Let's eat the breads. What's up with that? Why are we eating the breads? How can Kohanim, how can human being, priests, be eating the bread And what's the meaning of it? And if they're eating it, is that somehow a holy experience? What is going on? Okay. And in fact, many people, many commentaries were puzzled by the whole meaning behind the table, the shulchan. You know, you have something like the menorah, it's about illumination. You have the ark, it houses the tablets, the law, and it's a place where God communicated his wishes. You have the altar, it's a place of sacrifice. But what's the theme of the table? The priests eating bread? Like, what's the, why is the table with the bread, the 12 loaves of bread, why is that in the Holy Temple? What's the spiritual meaning behind it? In fact, take a look at text number 6. Sorry, page 89.
The use of the altar for incense and the altar for burnt offerings and their vessels is obvious. But I do not know the object of the table with the bread upon it continually, and up to this day I have not been able to assign any reason for this commandment.
And who says that?
Maimonides.
Maimonides, in his guide for the perplexed, he says, I've analyzed, I've studied, I've explored, I've pondered the shulchan, the table, and I don't understand the reason for it. I don't see the symbolism or the rationale behind it. It's a very interesting statement. Maimonides to say, it's, you know, I'm baffled by this. That's what he says. He says, I am perplexed. And the guy for the perplexed says, I'm perplexed by the shulchan. I understand the altar for incense. I understand the altar for burning, for the burnt offerings and other vessels. But the table with the bread doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Random question. So Yosef Karo came after Maimonides,
yes,
right? And is there the idea that the Shulchan Aruch, this idea of a set table, is this somehow connected spiritually to the idea of where we're going today?
No, not in an overt or obvious way, but it's an interesting point that you mentioned. His code of Jewish law, he wrote Shulchan Aruch because his goal was to lay out the law like, ready, accessible, like not that you have to pull from here and pull from here, and you know, it's all laid out for you. All the laws are laid out for you. But it is ironic that a modern incarnation of Jewish law, that kind of Maimonides was the first one really to organize, is called Shulchan Aruch, and he was puzzled by the Shulchan. But I don't know of any, you know, conceptual connection. Okay. And that interesting idea. Now, although Rambam, Maimonides, says that he doesn't understand the reason for the shulchan, for the table with the showbread, nonetheless, others have ascribed a rationale for it. Take a look at text number 7. This actually comes from an ancient midrash. And the Midrash ascribes a significance to the table. Mike.
In your Shomiko table, the Shulchan is reminiscent of the manna, as it is stated. You set a table before me in the presence of my adversaries.
Okay, so let's try to understand this. The Midrash says, on the verse of the Asisa Shulchan, and you shall make a table, the Midrash says, the table, the Shulchan, the table is reminiscent of the manna. The manna from heaven. Someone explain that to me. What's the connection between the showbread, the table with the showbread, and the manna from heaven? What's the
God provides sustenance no matter what. You know, I mean, there's a God satiates.
So God satiates with the manna. What does that have to do with the showbread that we baked?
Oh, there's the avodah, the doing, the taking something, the raw ingredients, and creating something.
Okay, but that's us creating. The whole point of the manna is that God is creating it. It's almost like the opposite.
But what I'm tuning into is in the presence of my adversaries. Because when you make this bread for the Shulchan in the Mishkan, you're saying that I have faith that you're going to take care of me, just like you took care of me in the desert with the man. You'll take care of me in the presence of my enemies.
And King David, there's actually a verse from Psalms. King David says, that even in this, in the place of my adversaries, King David was a hunted man for many years of his life, or for years of his life. Nonetheless, he has faith in God that God's going to take care of him.
Well, the showbread is blessed so that it provides by God, so that it provides enough for all the priests.
For the priests. Okay, good, good. So it's kind of like blessed bread. Good. Okay. Let's take a look at what Rabbeinu Bachaya says. Rabbeinu Bachaya is, again, classic medieval commentary. He has a very interesting take on the Shulchan and its connection, as we'll see soon, its connection to the manna. Text number 8, Dan.
Understood simply, the Shulchan was placed in the house of God in order to serve as a starting point that the blessing can attach itself to. The showbread was eaten by the priests who served in the temple. A small quantity of bread would satiate a large number of priests, as our sages stated. Quote, any priest who received even a pall, minuscule measurement, sized portion became satiated. Thus it was called the Shulchan, for God would send souls, Shaleach, his blessing through the bread, and from there the blessing would be sent forth to all as sustenance for the entire world.
So take a look at what, thank you, take a look at what Rabbeinu Bachaya says. He says that the bread on the table was blessed, and it was blessed in a way that it would provide a lot of sustenance, even in small measure. And he says, what does that mean? He says, what it means is, or the significance of this is, in a sense, the handle that God's blessing has on the world, in order for God's blessing to take effect on the world, it has to have a starting point where it first holds on. And where does it first hold on to? It first holds on to the Shulchan, to the table in the Mishkan. You see, he says, the first paragraph there was understood simply, the Shulchan was placed in the house of God in order to serve as a starting point that the blessing can attach itself to. In other words, God's ethereal, mystical, spiritual, divine blessing has to have a starting point from where it can develop. So where's the starting point? In the Mishkan, or in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash. And where in the temple was specifically the starting point? With the showbread. So that was the first bread, the material sustenance that was blessed. And from there, other material blessings happen. In other words, the ark is a place of divine communication. The altar is a place of sacrifice and worship. And what is the Shulchan? What is the table? It's a place of divine blessings of prosperity. God blesses the bread. God blesses the world. Just like God blessed the world with the manna, God blesses our material lives. In other words, it's all about God's blessing, the flow from above to below. That's seemingly what Rabbeinu Bachaya says, until we add one more twist. But I want to make sure that everyone understands this. Yeah? The theme of the Shulchan makes sense. So Maimonides says, I don't understand what the Shulchan is about. What's with the table with the bread? What's the point? And so now we have a Midrash and Rabbeinu Bachaya that when we put it together, what's the theme? The theme is God's provisions, God's sustenance, God's blessings. You know, there's a blessing in the Amidah. One of the blessings is a blessing for what we call parnasa, or we call sustenance. You know, having what we need, having material blessings. And so this was the very first entry of material blessings in the world, in the epicenter, the spiritual epicenter of the world, in the temple. This was the space where blessings first began to take hold in a material way, with the bread on the table, and from there it went and spread out throughout the rest of the world. Make sense? Sort of? Sort of? Okay. But we need to add one more piece. One more twist. And that twist is as follows. Who made the bread?
People.
And who ate the bread?
Priests.
And so the question could be asked, wait a second. If the theme of the table is God giving blessings, Why isn't God making the bread? Why are we making the bread? Furthermore,
Why don't the people get the bread?
Well, the people are, the people are making and are...
They get the bread.
The people are not getting the bread. The priests are getting the bread. And furthermore, you can ask, the temple is designated as a place for our, somehow, our worship, our efforts. What efforts do we have here? If God is doing all the blessing, what are we doing? And so here we come to an even deeper insight, a little bit of a twist on what we just explained, and that is that God says, I wish to give my blessing, my material blessings, to all. But I need someone to partner with. So I need you to make, to take the raw material, the raw wheat, the raw grains, and I need you to take the raw ingredients and make it into bread. And then take the bread and provide it to those in need. Remember, the priests didn't have their own land. They didn't have their own income. They were dependent on the charity, if you will, of the people. So God says, I wish to bless you with immense prosperity, all of you with prosperity, but here's how it's going to work. The way it works is, I need you, or I want you, to facilitate it. I'm going to give you the resources, and now you facilitate. So it turns out that in an even deeper understanding of the Shulchan, what is the message of the table with the showbread? It's the notion that you and I are empowered by God to be God's messengers to make the manna fall from heaven for all of us. In other words, in ancient desert times, God took care of it himself. In the temple, we have a table. And the table has bread, baked by humans, given to humans. And the message there is, this is also a blessing from God. But God doesn't want to keep on doing the miracle. God wants you and I to be the miracle. So the Shulchan, the table, is a place where we are encouraged, we are inspired, we are called forth to be God's mechanism to deliver the blessings of food, of a livelihood, to those that need. Does it make sense?
Well, man didn't supply the manna. The manna.
Correct. That's the distinction. So in the desert, outside of the tabernacle, so the manna fell directly from heaven. No human intervention, no humans interceded in that. It came straight from God. In the temple, God says, this is a place where it's all about your worship, your avodah, your service. What service do we have if God is doing all the providing? So where do we come in? Look around the world. Right? God provides what God provides, and you and I are called upon to help someone in need. Right? Well, God provides all the resources, sunlight and oxygen and crops that grow, and yet people are hungry in this world. People don't have bread to eat. And a person might say, well, what's the problem? You live in a world, there are trees, there are plants, there's food around. The reality is not everyone has food. Not everyone has a place to live. You and I are encouraged by the Shulchan's message to bake bread and give it out. To create homes, right? Habitat for Humanity. To build a home for someone else. Or to give tzedakah for someone else. That's the message of the Shulchan. Turns out that we have something absolutely incredible. The three vessels that we focused on tonight, the ark, the altar, and the table, represent the three pillars of Judaism and the three pillars of the world. Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasadim. Let me explain. Take a look. Oh, before we get there, text 9. If a person could live 120 years, and their only avodah could be trying to internalize text number 9. In other words, being sincere about it, living by it, not just knowing the motto, but actually living by it. Text number 9. And
another person's physical welfare is for me a spiritual matter.
Look at that. The Chassidim used to say, the older Chassidim used to say back in the day, the Chassidim of yesteryear used to say, another Yenem's Gashmius, that person's physical needs, is by Miruchnius, is a mitzvah. It's a spiritual matter for me. In other words, providing someone's material needs is not just, yeah, so somebody needed a meal, I cooked for them a meal. Okay, let me get back to some spiritual stuff. Are you kidding me? Is there anything more spiritual than providing someone's material needs? I mentioned a few times I'm working on a book. I actually just wrapped it up, just finished the book. We're working on now production elements. The book is about inclusion and the power of the individual. And the Rebbe has a talk, I forget which year he said it, unbelievable idea, on the concept of loving your fellows yourself. The Rebbe says there's a misnomer with loving your fellows yourself, because you think that loving your fellows yourself means that you should give them what you need, right? Loving your fellow as yourself means whatever you like, you should give to them. So for my wife's birthday, theoretically, if this were true, I would give her a set of golf clubs. Why? Because love your fellow as yourself. I would want golf clubs, so I should get her golf clubs. Love your fellow as yourself. The Rebbe says, obviously, that's not true. For example, you have two people. One person is thirsty, one person is hungry. So let's say you're the one who's thirsty. All you need is water, right? You're just dying for water, not literally. But they don't have any food. They need a piece of bread. So imagine, out of your love for them, you're going to give them what you feel connected with, what you desire. You give them water. You give them a barrel of water. Happy birthday. Mazel tov. Enjoy the gift. Have you satisfied their need?
No.
Nope. You've missed the whole point. In the category or under the guise of love your fellow as yourself, you've actually loved yourself as yourself. You haven't gotten to know what they need. And so the Rebbe continues, and he says in the same talk, he says, if someone needs material help, physical help, right? Something, money, food, whatever it is, something physical. And you say, listen, I'm a scholar, I'm a rabbi, I'm an intellectual, so I'm going to share with you wisdom. It's not loving your fellow as yourself. Because loving your fellow, v'yahavta l'racha kamocha, means not that you have to treat them literally like you want to be treated right now, or to give them what you're excited about. Oh, I'm excited about wisdom, let me give you wisdom. It's to take care, to be there for them as they need right now. And so therefore, the chassidim used to say, another person's physical welfare is for me a spiritual matter. It's an avodah, it's a spiritual service. It's serving God by cooking and delivering a meal to someone. Baking challah for a new mom or someone in the hospital and delivering challah is, yeah, you can't say that it's not necessarily one of the 613 mitzvot, but it's a spiritual service. And sometimes we think, no, spiritual service is studying Torah and praying and meditating and whatever, but the physical stuff, the stuff that we, helping out somebody stuck on the side of the road and stopping and helping them, come on, that's a spiritual thing. Another person's physical welfare is for me a spiritual matter.
Is that being a Don Mojave Row or not?
Yes. 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 Between the interpersonal stuff. That's the message of the Shulchan. The Shulchan table reminds us that it's up to us to bake and feed the priests. Yes, God will bless the endeavor, but it's we who do that. And that's not a side. It's something nice, but something that's not holy. That's in the temple. In the temple, you make a table and you put it in the Kodesh, not the Holy of Holies, but in the Kodesh and the Holies, right outside of the Holy of Holies. There were three things: a menorah, the table with the bread, and the inner altar upon which they burn just the incense. Those are the three items there. So you have this bread, this table with the bread. And it's in a space that's called Kodesh, a space that's called holy. And what is it? Physical bread baked by physical people that's going to be eaten by other physical people. So what's the holy? Rambam says, Maimani says, I don't understand. Why is this a holy item? Why is this a holy vessel? You tell me oil and light and fire, mystical. You tell me incense and altars, beautiful. Arks with tablets, fantastic. But bread? What is the bakery? This too is holy. That's the point. This too is holy. And so now we have the three pillars. Take a look at text number 10. Sorry. Forget text 10. Text 10 is wonderful, but kind of already paraphrased some of that. Text 11. Tim.
Shimon the Righteous was among the last surviving members of the Gui Assembly. He would say, the world stands on three things: Torah, the service of God, and deeds of kindness.
The world stands on three things. There are three pillars of the world. The study of Torah, the service of God, which is a euphemism for prayer, and gemilus chasadim, which means deeds of kindness, chesed, acts of kindness. What does it mean? Well, he's talking about, in our context, three vessels: the ark, the altar, and the table. What is the ark? We said before, it houses the tablets. What did the tablets have on it? Ten Commandments, the Torah, the core of the Torah. And as we cited earlier from Ramban, from Nachmanides, what happened at the space of the ark? That's where God communicated his will to mankind. Well, what is Torah if not? When you study Torah, what do you get? Divine communication. So you want to go in the Holy of Holies and hear God's voice? I have a backup plan. Crack open a Torah. A Torah, right? Crack. Open a Coke. No, so, right? Study Torah. Study Torah. And you're hearing God's voice resonating from the ark, from the Holy of Holies. So Torah study, the first pillar of Torah study, the ark is symbolic of that. Well, what about avodah? What about prayer? It's the altar. Why? The altar was a place where animal sacrifices were brought. From the time the temple was destroyed and no animal sacrifice could be brought, what took the place of the sacrifices?
Prayer.
We have the text here, the famous text from Talmud Brachot, the first tractate of the entire Talmud, text 12, which we're not going to read inside. And it talks about how the three daily prayers that we have, morning, afternoon, and evening, are not only modeled after those sacrificial services that happen morning, afternoon, and evening, but occur at those very same times. There were offerings that had to be brought in the morning, so you have morning prayers. And afternoon. And at night, they burn various parts of the animal that need to still burn on the altar. And that's why we have a Ma'ariv, an Arvit, an evening, a nighttime service. And so the prayers were instituted to correspond to the daily sacrifices. That's what Rabbi Shulman Levi says, the opening line of text 12. The prayers were instituted to correspond to the daily sacrifices. And the truth is, thematically, it holds true. Well, what is prayer? Prayer is a person, a human being, a normal human being, sitting or standing in one place and saying words to God. Is that easy? It's not easy. It requires opening up oneself, breaking oneself open, suspending or subjugating or subduing one's ego, which might say, if I need something, let me figure it out myself. I'm able to subdue my ego and communicate with God. Be vulnerable. All of this requires sacrifice. Sacrifice today is a dirty word. Don't want to say sacrifice. To live a life of sacrifice? What is this? The 1800s? Who's sacrificing? Live a good life. Okay. So we don't have animal sacrifices, but we have the sacrifice that we can make. And in our service of God, sacrifices correspond to prayer because prayer requires effort. I've said this countless times. The most difficult Jewish practice is prayer. It's without a doubt. It's the one thing that I've heard again and again and again from people saying, I just don't get it. I don't connect. Like, what's going on? I'm just saying some words on a page? What's supposed to happen? It's the hardest. It's the hardest thing. To wrap tefillin, it's not that hard. Light Shabbat candles, not that hard. Yeah, kosher, Shabbos, there are details that are hard, but it feels meaningful. Sit in a synagogue and read from words that you didn't write yourself in a foreign language. Knock yourself out. It's avoda. It's work. It's sacrifice. It requires opening oneself up, putting the ego aside, and really stepping into that space. That's why Chassidim used to spend an hour before davening preparing. Because how do you jump right in? If you jump right in, you're not davening. So it took an hour before. The davening was an hour. And then they spent an hour, what do they call it after you work out, like cooling off or whatever, right? So an hour afterwards, studying and reintegrating back. The point is that the three pillars, pillar number one is Torah study, that's the ark. Pillar number two is avoda, service, prayer, that was the altar. And the third pillar is acts of kindness. being there physically, not just spiritually, physically for someone else. What, which vessel in the temple or the Mishkan, the tabernacle, represented that chesed, that giving?
The table.
The table, the shulchan. And so now we see why it is that Maimonides says the altar. That's what makes the temple a temple. Nachmanides says, what makes the temple a temple? The ark. I don't know if anyone said that about the table, but maybe we, you know, maybe we'll say that. The table was a bit. Why do you have different opinions? And here's the final punchline of today's class. And that is that everyone has their own disposition. Some people are more intellectually inclined. For them, what do they love about Judaism? They love studying Torah. They are ark people. Some people are emotional. They love the emotive connections. They love feelings. Feelings are amazing. For them, maybe their space in Judaism is prayer. And they connect with the altar. They are altar people. And then you have those who may not be the studious ones, who may not have all the feelings and all the feels, but these people, they're there for someone else when they need it. When someone's going through a difficult time, they pick up the phone, they show up, they're the first ones there. You know, someone needs something, they cook the food, they cook the meal and bring it over. And you say, yeah, but what about the study? What about the prayer? They got the third pillar locked down. They are table Jews. They are table folk. So which is greater? There's no point to discuss which is greater. They're all great. They're all pillars of the world, let alone pillars of Judaism and a Jewish community. They're all pillars that uphold the world. You have to have Torah study. You have to have divine communication. You have to know divine communication. You have to open up to God, and you have to be there for someone else. But here's the kicker. Again, each one of us has an inclination, likely inclination, toward one over the other. And that's an okay thing. It's all right to prefer one over the other. Now, we're meant to be well-rounded individuals, and we're meant to, you know, to circulate and to be involved in all areas, all three pillars, have the ark, have the altar, and have the table in our lives to build out those in our divine service in our lives. True. But nonetheless, we're going to gravitate toward one over the other. And that's not a bad thing. And so as we recognize, as we think about, so what type of person am I? You know, what type of person am I? Am I an ark person, an altar person, or am I a table person? As we think about that for ourselves, we might also wish to think about the other person. And if the other person is not like us, it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with them. It just means that they're different. Somebody who's an intellectual might say, there's nothing, I have no commonality with this person. I'm studying Torah and this person is not a Torah scholar. So what type of relationship can we have? Well, one second. You're all vessels in the same temple, right? You're all pillars that are holding up the world. So you do it this way, you do it that way, but there, of course, there's a commonality. If you think about the fact that the ark, the altar, and the table were all housed in God's holy tabernacle and are described in this week's Torah portion, perhaps we can be a little bit more tolerant of the person who does things a little bit differently than we do. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies. Well timed. Thank you.
Tell a story that your wife Leah told.